We look back to the transition of power from the U.S. to the Afghan government with a South Dakotan who was part of it. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Tuesday, August 17th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we welcome South Dakota's state historian Ben Jones. Lieutenant Colonel Jones served in Afghanistan twice, once as an advisor at the National Military Academy of Afghanistan, and later as part of the group that helped with the official transition process. Then we look at the promise and policy of carbon banking for South Dakota farmers. Can that policy deliver on the promise? We hear from South Dakota musician Mateau and talk about the FX on Hulu series Reservation Dogs. That's coming later in the hour. We are broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB News, I'm Jenna Scott. One of the country's tech giants is partnering with a tribal-owned wind farm project in South Dakota. The Yocheti Shikoi Power Authority is one of 15 businesses selected for Apple's inaugural Impact Accelerator program. Apple will provide training and networking for Black, Hispanic, and Native American-owned eco-friendly businesses. SDPB's Ariel Zions has more on the project and its new partnership.
The Yocheti Shikoi Power Authority is owned by six tribes and hopes to build wind farms on the Pine Ridge and Cheyenne River reservations. Lyle Jack is a member of the Oglala Sioux Tribe and chairman of the Power Authority. He says the project aligns with the tribe's values and geography.
We are taught to take care of the Mother Earth, or we call her Nchimaka, which is Grandmother Earth, and take care of the environment that we live in. That's why tribes are against pipelines and digging for oil or gas. Secondly, renewable energy is clean energy that falls within our beliefs. Thirdly is we have an abundance of wind, some of the best wind resources in the United States.
The wind farms won't be generating energy for the tribes. Instead, the energy will be sold to government agencies and corporations, with the revenues being invested back with the tribes. Lyle says the project will benefit from the Impact Accelerator program.
Well, it's going to open some doors to either, some potential energy buyers. It's going to get our name out there. To be affiliated with Apple is always a feather in anyone's cap in the business world. Also, allows us to share ideas with other companies that are going through the same thing we are.
The wind project won't need state permits since it's a federally chartered company being built on tribal land. It's going through an environmental assessment and will need to be approved by federal agencies. The Power Authority hopes to begin construction by 2023 and go online the next year. I'm SDPB's Ariel Zions.
The Sturgis city manager says the motorcycle rally that ended Sunday might be the second largest in more than a decade. Daniel Ainsley says that includes a demographic shift due to COVID restrictions.
Unlike kind of traditional rallies, we still did not have very many international visitors. Usually international visitors make up 10 to 15% of the crowd. This year is about 1 to 2%. So it was a lot more American focused.
A new open container rule went into effect during the rally. It allowed people to have open containers of alcohol downtown. Ainsley says the initiative was well received.
That was something that was used to try to mitigate, obviously, some of the issues that are still revolving around COVID-19 to make sure that people are able to be outdoors a lot more and not feel as crowded or cramped kind of in a lot of the bars.
There were 60 injury accidents and 4 deaths during the rally. Those numbers are only slightly changed from last year. Meanwhile, arrests for serious crimes were down while citations and warning tickets were up. Coronavirus cases are climbing in South Dakota, but the number of hospitalizations from the virus dipped. The Department of Health reported 182 new cases, pushing the tally of people with active infections statewide to just over 1,300. People hospitalized with the virus dropped to 73 over the weekend. Over the past 2 weeks, the rolling average number of daily new cases has tripled. However, more people are getting vaccinated as the Delta virus variant threatens to power a fresh surge of cases. Over 2,500 more people received a vaccine, according to the Department of Health. With SDPB News, I'm Jenna Scott.
And I'm Lori Walsh. The U.S. Census Bureau has released 2020 census results. You can expect more information from the census in the weeks and even months ahead. The census count was plagued with challenges as the 10-year count took place during a pandemic. The federal government under the Trump administration sought limitations on how long the count could proceed, and new privacy initiatives have created what's called statistical noise that might impact how you find data for South Dakota communities with the smallest population bases. Weiwei Zhang is the South Dakota State demographer, and she joins us now to go over some of the basics of this year's census count. Dr. Zhang, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So in the census, every 10 years, every American is supposed to be counted. Always challenges to that. Can you give me a quick summary of what some of the challenges we saw during this census count were and whether we think that the data is still good or good enough to use?
Well, the first challenge is the timeline, right? That has been disrupted by the pandemic. And then there's also the because of the disrupting the timeline, and then Census Bureau has taken multiple actions to adjust the timeline and also make sure that all the faces and operational faces are on the place and all the necessary components are carried out necessarily and appropriately.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk a little bit about differential privacy, which is new. And when you're accessing the data and trying to, you know, dig into it deeply to use it, what do you need to know about that so-called statistical noise?
Well, the differential privacy, it's not a new thing that's been or technology or method adopted by the Census Bureau. So in other census data products, Census Bureau has been using differential privacy, which is part of their method to make sure that there's the DAS, the disclosure avoidance system, part of their disclosure avoidance system. So this year, this 2020 census, they do have this differential privacy, which is, well, by principle, is actually add noise or do some data swapping, more than data swapping, which is being used in the past to the data. But then for the state level, the total counts, the number is accurate. But then for the sub-geographies, especially for the geography that has a much smaller population, to avoid the individual information being revealed, basically to protect the data confidentiality, then the data, the differential privacy will be applied there.
So basically, if you're using this information to look at what's happening in rural communities of South Dakota, do you have actionable data to reference, or are there challenges that are not overcomeable? That's not a word, but
Well, yes, and there are the Census Bureau are currently looking at all the before they released the data, they actually have been released multiple versions of the data for testing. They used for on the 2010 to test their different mathematical algorithms to build the differential privacy. I actually did look at some of their alpha, beta, or different types of versions. And there are some concerns, but it's, and I think I personally have some, my own feedback on that. And for some part of, especially the rural areas, if we want to look at the detailed tabulations, meaning that if you want to look at the statistics by more than two or three characteristics, for example, age 6 to 11 and by a certain racial ethnic group, and then that statistics, I think I will be conservatively using that statistics.
Yeah, good to know. All right, let's talk about some of the key takeaways from the data that we already have. What are you seeing with some of these, the early information and your assessment of it?
Yeah, the data released on last Thursday, which is August 12th, is the first release, which is on their legacy form. And then by September, late September, I think the Bureau will release the redistricting data on the more like user-friendly form. And this, the set of data released on August the 12th. And I've been looking at, they released all the counts by the population by racial ethnic groups and also the voting age population and the housing units by vacancy and the rental or the owner status for all geographies. I was just looking at the county level. For our state, we had a 8.9% increase in the last decade, which is actually higher than the percent increase in the last previous decade. And then, of course, the growth is not evenly across the state. And I think people are probably expecting to see the uneven distribution. And the counties that in the state that has the faster growth are the counties that near the metro, two metros in the state, right? Sioux Falls and Rapid City. And Lincoln County is the number one faster growing county in the past in the last decade, which had more than 45% increase. And most of our these trends are actually very much mimic or like matching the national trend. And also for the counties that are losing population are most of the counties that are already had a smaller population. So meaning the rural and the remote located counties are continuing losing population. So this is a kind of the state overall population trend and also the geographic distribution in the last decade.
Fascinating stuff. We will be talking about it now and in the days to come. One quick final question for you, Doctor, and that is, Dr. Zhang, the undercount and overcount information, we expect that when? Because that could be significant with this year as well. We always expect some kind of undercount and overcount in some areas, but this year it could be even more. When does that estimation come out?
Usually they will. Census Bureau will release the post-census estimate of the undercount and overcount by the end of the year. But this year, the timeline for all the programs has been adjusted.
Sure.
So I haven't been notified of their exact time for their release that the report of undercount and overcount. So I will keep an eye for that.
All right. Weiwei Zhang is South Dakota State demographer. Thank you so much for being here with us. We appreciate your time.
Thanks.
Ahead on the program, the push to silence animal rights advocates and whistleblowers goes to court. Victoria Wicks reports on ag gag legislation after the break. You're on listener supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Robin Young. We'll have the latest on the situation in Afghanistan and Haiti. Also, the Federal Restaurant Revitalization Fund is out of money, and only a third of restaurants who applied got it. We'll check in with an owner facing closure.
It's my whole life. We're hurting so much right now. We need these funds.
Next time, Here and Now. This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by First Dakota National Bank. Every timeless institution, tradition, and thriving business was started somewhere by someone who had a dream. Here's to those who made it happen first. FirstDakota.com/first.
Walk out the door and your world changes. Dark to light, quiet to noise. The stars, the sounds of insects and birds, kids playing, waves crashing, cars passing. Even in our most peaceful moments, the world is always moving, changing. Something big is happening somewhere. Take NPR with you and stay connected to the world outside your door. Listen live on your phone, at this station's website, or npr.org.
Listen at sdpb.org or download our app.
Program funding is provided by Sanford Underground Research Facility, supporting South Dakota teachers and students with classroom resources, field trips, and professional development. Learn more at sanfordlab.org.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. The Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals has issued opinions on two so-called ag-gag laws, one out of Arkansas, the other from Iowa. Ag-gag laws attempt to keep whistleblowers and animal activists from having access to the inner workings of agricultural processing facilities. Those would include slaughterhouses and concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs. The Arkansas law threatens civil sanctions for whistleblowers and investigators. The appeals court found that law to be unconstitutional in that it stifles free speech. But the court upheld most of an Iowa law threatening criminal sanctions for people who misrepresent their role to gain access to the facility. Victoria Wicks reports on these opinions for SDPB.
Upton Sinclair's novel, The Jungle, was published in 1906 and forever changed the meatpacking industry. Sinclair exposed disgusting practices and hazardous conditions that spurred federal action, including the Meat Inspection Act, the Pure Food and Drug Act, and eventually the Food and Drug Administration, or FDA. Today, states across the nation have passed ag-gag laws designed to limit access to facilities that conduct animal research, process meat, and raise confined animals. Plaintiffs challenging these laws say the state's intent is to rein in exposés by activists and journalists. Ag-gag laws in two of those states, Arkansas and Iowa, are the subject of two opinions by the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. The Eighth Circuit held a special session in February to hear arguments about the Arkansas law that allows owners of animal production facilities to sue anyone, including activists and whistleblowers, for doing harm to the business. This legislation was sponsored by Deanne Vaught, a pig farmer and state legislator. David Muraskin represents the Animal Legal Defense Fund and Animal Equity at oral arguments. He tells the three-judge panel that activists intended to send investigators into Prayer Creek Farm, owned by Deanne Vaught and her husband, as well as into Pico Foods, a poultry processor. But he says those plans were put on hold because of the state law. Activists fearing lawsuits engaged in self-censorship, and as a result, the statute has the unconstitutional effect of chilling free speech. Muraskin says animal activists have a reason to believe there's something to find in these two facilities. He makes two factual allegations about Pico Foods.
First, that they have increased line speed, and second, that they use what a slaughter technique known as live hang.
And he says Deanne Vaught's effort to legislate away any scrutiny suggests there's something to be found.
Plaintiffs explain that they wish to reveal what's going on at Deanne Vaught's farm precisely because she sponsored this law.
Muraskin says the Animal Legal Defense Fund and Animal Equity have fought ag-gag laws across the country, and part of their strategy is to reveal how these laws have been used to suppress facts. Muraskin is asked why plaintiffs can't just take what they know and make it public without entering the facility. He replies plaintiffs want video and other documentation as a valuable component of their constitutionally protected political speech.
They show the information to the public, and they believe that by showing the information to the public, they can build political pressure for change. And that's what they want to do.
The Eighth Circuit finds in favor of the plaintiffs, but not unanimously. Judge Bobby Shepard dissents, saying that plaintiffs' fears of being sued are just speculative until they take a course of action that results in harm to the businesses, such as prosecutions, food safety recalls, citations, and closures. According to online sources, Upton Sinclair went undercover in Chicago meatpacking plants to gather information for his novel, The Jungle. Online sources don't say if he lied to get inside or lied to get a job, but it follows that he might not have gotten through the door had he announced his intentions. In Iowa in 2012, lawmakers made it a crime to gain access or employment at an ag facility by means of false or fraudulent statements. Activists sued, claiming free speech violations. When looking at the effect of a law challenged on free speech grounds, the court has to determine if the law bans the content of the speech or the conduct of the speaker. At oral arguments in September 2020, Assistant Attorney General Jacob Larson defends Iowa's law. He says the state is on solid ground when it criminalizes lying to get inside a facility because it is punishing the conduct, the trespassing, not the speech, the lying.
It's primarily addressed at conduct, that is facilitated by false speech. The false speech is integral to the criminal act that's occurring. You wouldn't have a trespass in this case without the false speech.
In its opinion, the judges agreed and upheld that part of Iowa's law. But judges found that the portion of the law criminalizing false statements for employment was too broad because it did not specify that the statements must be material to the hiring process. At oral arguments, Matthew Strugar represents the Animal Legal Defense Fund and four other organizations.
There are historical content-based exclusions from the First Amendment.
Strugar says examples of unprotected speech are threats and obscenity, and he says some forms of dishonesty can carry legal sanctions, perjury, defamation, and fraud, for instance. He acknowledges that the U.S. Supreme Court's Alvarez decision specifically mentions lying to gain employment as a punishable offense, but he says that decision doesn't apply to all statements, such as the kind of puffery an applicant engages in to flatter the boss.
It seems clear that Justice Kennedy's talking about an applicant who exaggerates his qualifications to get a job. And, you know, in that situation, there is a kind of unjust enrichment or some kind of fraud in such that, you know, the employer believes he's bargaining for something that he doesn't get.
Strugar says during his arguments that the Iowa legislature passed a new ag gag law after the lower court enjoined this one, and the new law specifies that the misstatements during job interviews have to be material to be punishable. He says that law is currently tied up in a challenge in district court. If so, that new law might already offer the fix required by the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals. As with the Arkansas opinion, this appellate panel voted 2-1, with Judge Raymond Grunder dissenting from the court's finding on employment. Judge Stephen Graz concurred with the opinion because it is consistent with current law, but he says it, quote, tests the outer boundaries of protection of speech under the First Amendment. He says this case might pit investigative journalism against private property rights, and he's concerned that this opinion opens a new category of speech that the government can punish through criminal prosecution. Graz says eventually the Supreme Court will have to decide if such laws can be sustained or whether they infringe on the breathing room necessary to fulfill the promise of the First Amendment. The ruling of the Court of Appeals applies to the 7 states within the 8th Circuit, which includes South Dakota. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Victoria Wicks.
You can find this story and share it on our website at sdpb.org/news. Coming up on the program, as Afghanistan falls to the Taliban, we look back on the surge of troops during the Obama administration. State historian Ben Jones was there. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
On the next Fresh Air, tennis great Billie Jean King. In a new memoir, she describes her hard-fought battles to win recognition and pay for women in the sport, her legendary Battle of the Sexes defeat of Bobby Riggs in the Astrodome, and some joyous and painful moments in her personal life. The book is called All In. Join us. This afternoon at 2, One Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by Denny Menhold Rapid Chevrolet in Rapid City, inviting you to experience the peace of mind and more that come with driving a certified vehicle from Denny Menhold Rapid Chevrolet. See you at Denny Menhold Rapid Chevrolet in Rapid City.
Hi, this is Steve Inskeep with NPR, here to thank sustaining members of this station. Public radio is here for you every day, no matter what, and when you give automatically every month, you continually show that you're here for us and for this community. Thank you so much for your support.
Monthly sustaining supporters form a strong foundation for SDPB. Sustaining donations are ones SDPB can count on to fund programs you love. Thank you.
Program funding by the Museum and the South Dakota Cultural Heritage Center in Pierre, now offering free admission to South Dakota residents and children from everywhere. Coronavirus protections in place. Learn more by calling the Cultural Heritage Center or visit history.sd.gov.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. President Joe Biden says he does not regret his decision to withdraw the U.S. military from Afghanistan, though in an address to the nation yesterday, he said he was deeply saddened by the facts we now face. Today we're going to talk about some of those facts and provide a little context for how we got here. Lieutenant Colonel Ben Jones served in Afghanistan twice, first as an advisor at the National Military Academy of Afghanistan in 2009, and later as a member of the Strategic Transition and Assessment Group. That was from 2011 to 2012. Jones is now retired from the U.S. Air Force. He holds a Ph.D. in history, and he currently serves as South Dakota's state historian. He agreed to stop by the SDPB Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls to talk about some of that experience. Dr. Jones, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks.
The collapse of the Afghan government and military, the coalition, came more quickly than the Biden administration anticipated, is what the president said to us yesterday. But in many years, the collapse really could have been predicted. Yes? No?
Well, a lot of things could have been predicted, I guess. I think one of the, when we think about planning military operations and the conduct of war and stuff, one of the things that your leaders should be concerned about is something called the center of gravity, which is something that if taken apart by the enemy, then your ability to operate is diminished. General Allen, who I worked for at one of those jobs in Afghanistan, was the commander of ISAF forces in Afghanistan in 2011. He took over in June of 2011. He said early on in his tenure that the center of gravity for us was the coalition itself, was our relationship within NATO partners and those non-NATO members who were bringing troops and support to Afghanistan, as well as that there should not be any daylight between the coalition and the Afghan government. And when there was noticeable differences between the two, that those should be hashed out in private and that we should not, that should not be exposed because the Taliban could take advantage of that, that they can see, oh, there's a distinction between what the coalition is saying or what the United States is saying and what the Afghan government is saying or able to do, and that they could, in the expression, there should be no daylight, they could, drive a freight train through there and exploit that. I found it very odd then, personally, to be watching the Obama administration at the time attempt to unilaterally negotiate with the Taliban, even secretly in a third country, to be negotiating with them tells the Taliban that, the Afghan government isn't here at the table. It's just the two of us, the United States and the Taliban, and we'll work out a deal and we'll tell the government later. That's daylight that you can drive a train through. And I think so that, in my view, set up the long train of events that the Taliban continued to exploit since 2011-12 when those negotiations started.
There were always different goals for the transition. The transition itself has been planned for some time, but people were coming at this from different goals. And you write about this in a chapter in the book, Our Latest Longest War. I think it was the first time I ever interviewed you was about this book or perhaps about your own book on Eisenhower's guerrillas. But you say from the beginning, they did not have the same goals.
Right.
How so? Explain that.
Well, in I think it must have been November or so of 2010, a NATO conference in, I think it was Lisbon. Yes, the Lisbon conference decided that it would be a conditions-based withdrawal. And what that means is as the Afghan forces are able to take over the war, that the coalition would recede, and that we set up, or that was concluded within the coalition then in November of 2010. When I arrived in the winter of 2011, that capability, that small organization of planners inside of General Petraeus' headquarters was just getting going, and and I was joining that team, and we set up kind of the definitions. We came to terms. We met with the Afghan generals and senior police leaders frequently to kind of understand the realities on the ground. So when we said conditions based, we came up with a common understanding and framework of what those conditions would be, understanding that the timeline was that the Afghans would be in charge everywhere, but that the support for them would continue based on conditions. That fell apart that summer when, and Secretary Gates writes about this in his book, and then I use that for this source in my chapter, that it was very evident to me that there was differences of understanding between the embassy across the street from where we were in Kabul, with the White House, with the things that the National Security Council would say to us, with other allies and how they understood that what conditions-based meant. And ultimately by June, when President Obama told General Petraeus in a meeting in the White House, I mean, I wasn't there for that, but General Petraeus shared that with the rest of us later that day. Over a teleconference, that conditions-based, essentially, he didn't put it this way, he was far more diplomatic, but essentially was the calendar. And that all forces would be out by the end of 2014. So if that's what it means, then the ability of the Afghan government to take over and for the Afghan army to fight the war really was not a tremendous concern of the United States government. It was, we're going to get out of here.
Yeah. President Obama wanted the U.S. military out of Afghanistan. President Trump wanted the U.S. Mm-hmm. military out of Afghanistan. President Biden wants the U.S. military out of Afghanistan.
Yep.
Do we have a U.S. interest in Afghanistan, in your opinion? I mean, I know that's three presidents and one retired lieutenant colonel speaking on that. But what can you add to that dialogue as far as, like, is it that, yes, we do need to get out and it was just a matter of time before somebody had to do this? Or do we still have interests there and this really should have been handled differently is what I'm trying to get
well,
at.
Well, when you think about with us gone now, Pakistan next door is a nuclear proliferator and they are emboldened and strengthened with us gone. So is that a good thing for the United States? I don't think so. The terrorist networks now are in high recruit mode bragging about what's going on in Kabul right now and in Kandahar and all over. And their social media and getting the word out, they're going to make hay for this for decades. So that's not good for the United States. Okay. So I would think that some other path to a lessening of the presence while maintaining something there to support the Afghan National Army in its fight against the Taliban would have been preference, in my opinion.
President Biden had some strong words for about the Afghan government, the Afghan military not willing. Why should American soldiers, why should American military members stand up for people who are not willing to stand up to themselves? That struck me personally is a very strong thing to say. You worked with a lot of these people.
Mm-hmm.
Did that, and I guess I can find my direct quote, but did that sort of tone that he took yesterday hit you in the same way that it was sort of hitting me, this almost accusation?
It's an accusation which over the past few weeks probably needs some explain. Well, I don't know why they haven't been fighting in the last few weeks, because for the last several years they've been taking thousands of casualties every year.
Mm-hmm.
So the accusation that the ANA won't fight over the past several years is just wrong. The question is, why did they give up in the last several weeks? I don't know the answer to that, but I was very disappointed in the president's comment about that yesterday. The accusatory tone, I thought, was unfounded.
Sounds like daylight to me, too.
Yes.
Again, that's a little editorializing there on my part, but I guess would you call that daylight would be the question. Like him saying that about the government of Afghanistan, does that tell other organizations something about American foreign policy that could seem like daylight is a better question?
You could certainly interpret it that way.
Have you been – what can you tell me about this evacuation process, because it seems like a huge humanitarian crisis just emerging in front of us and people on the ground who are trying to evacuate, find planes, move equipment, people hanging off of American aircraft.
Sure. Well,
painful to watch.
Yeah.
How does it land with you?
I have in the past also been a part of planning and then also in the operations of what's in military terms called a non-combatant evacuation operation, a NEO. These things are always very complex because you never really know what to expect when you get there. But one of the things that you have to make some assumptions, and one of the assumptions that one might make if you're planning one of these things is that the host country has the security for the airport taken care of. And by the looks of it on TV, it appears that that was an assumption that was holding until probably the airplanes landed. The Afghan army had the security of the airport taken care of. What does that mean? Well, that means that you don't have to check IDs at the plane. You're just loading the people that the Afghan government and the embassy has said are cleared to get on. But what we're seeing now is, at least in the first several hours of this, was people rushing the plane and aircrew making decisions based on just looking at the person and their state and trying to assess whether they could get on the aircraft or not. I mean, they are put in a very awful situation. One of the NEO that I was involved in, the passengers we were loading on were embassy staff and third country nationals that had approval to be there by the U.S. ambassador. So we didn't have to make that call. I can't imagine being a captain or a major aircrew commander and making the call with 640 people. Which evidently is the photograph that I've seen on one C-17 to fly them out. You know, you check them for security reasons and you put them on if you have the time to do that. I don't know how the frenetic pace. It's not what one would plan to do. And so you're doing it on the fly.
Do you have friends, colleagues, people that you know of that you suspect are left behind and unable to evacuate whose lives may be at risk now with the Taliban in charge?
Sure. I worked with several Afghan officers and police leadership, and I've tried to contact them. I heard from one Saturday evening over a LinkedIn instant message, right. if you can believe it. But I haven't heard from them since. I have another interpreter who's now in this country. He's got a green card and lives in the United States, and he's trying to get his parents and his brothers and sisters out. So they're in Kabul, and when I checked with him this morning, they seemed, as far as he knew, they were okay, but they're staying in their house.
This is another question that's maybe an unfair one, but there are a lot of veterans living in this state, probably listening right now, who served in Afghanistan or in Iraq, and this is incredibly personal mm-hmm. for them as well. Anything you want to say to them as someone who has been there yourself, watching this unfold, how do veterans process this time?
I would just say that veterans, since the dawn of time, have reflected on their war service in a very personal way, and those ways have been the most rewarding. So contact your fellows in arms that you served with and make sure they're okay. I've been contacted by friends in New Zealand and Australia and England and around the country as well, and I appreciate that. And so I would just continue that. And I would also say that, for 20 years, we showed them, the Afghan people, what the possibilities were. And I think that's something we can be proud of. And we also, the United States and the coalition, prevented an attack like 9/11 from happening again. It's hard to prove the negative, but we can also take some comfort in that.
Dr. Ben Jones, I want to say thank you for being here today,
sure.
Sharing a little bit of a personal story and giving us some context as well. I appreciate your time.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
Let's take a moment now to hear from one more person from the 81st Sturgis Motorcycle Rally. Sturgis rally goer Matt Hoffman wears a black outfit and has silver charms hanging from his long gray beard. Hoffman, who goes by Chewie, Chewbacca, and Wizard, also expresses himself through his above-the-knee prosthetic, which has a purple tie-dye background and painting of Jimi Hendrix. He added Grateful Dead Dancing Bear stickers and embedded a Harley-Davidson medallion into his joint. Wizard lost his leg in a 2015 Florida crash when a car turned in front of his bike, pushing him into another vehicle that launched him 20 feet across the street. He began riding again in 2018, and this year's rally was his first one since the crash. Wizard spoke with SDPB's Ariel Zients in Sturgis, where he shared his life philosophy and read one of his poems.
The paramedics got there. Were you wearing a helmet? No. Is this hurt? This. I said, guys, I am no doctor, but you see that bone popped out of my leg and that foot that looks like a meat rag? That's the problem area. One paramedic turns to the other one and says, cut his leather jacket off. I said, cut my leather jacket off? This is the $400 leather jacket 20 years ago, and now it's seasoned. I will ride until I die, and if I die while I ride, then so be it. I'm dying doing something that I love. I like to be free flowing in the wind. I'm not gonna lie, I live my life the way I want to because I'm not afraid to die. Cast my body into the sea, souls can't get wet. Knocked on death's door, haven't seen the other side yet. I've been asked to come to some poetry slams and I write it as an outlet. But if it helps others, then so be it. Never let the stories of speculation and twisted tales ever worry your tired eyes. They've tried to blind for all your days. Life is full of hills to climb, winding roads to the end of nowhere. Sometimes it feels like one big maze. Wills and bonds, even bones and promises can be broken. Just keep your third eye focused on what lies unwritten, unspoken. It's your soul's master plan. You are the light. Your spirit is the flame to spark the gateway as you start a new day. Now until eternity, no matter how rough the path or dark the night, sometimes we are basking in the coin of sunshine of tranquility, other times a dark cloud of disparity of a tragic toss. Life is not to be taken for granted. The one you live is the same one that'll be lost. The balance between pleasure as well as pain on one coin. Understand this concept is not as hard as it seems. If there were no nightmares to awake from, how could you even know or ever arrive somewhere the dark side of life's rainbows end and the bright colors of our own vivid dreams?
Coming up on the program, is carbon banking great potential for South Dakota producers, or is the policy more promise than impact? You're a listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Robin Young. We'll have the latest on the situation in Afghanistan and Haiti. Also, the Federal Restaurant Revitalization Fund is out of money, and only a third of restaurants who applied got it. We'll check in with an owner facing closure.
It's my whole life. We're hurting so much right now. We need these funds.
Next time, here and now. This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by the South Dakota Humanities Council, celebrating literature, promoting civil conversation, and telling the stories that define our state. Learn more at sdhumanities.org.
Coming up this evening on Jazz Nightly, we'll hear the trombone duo of Wayne Coniglio and Scott Whitfield, along with new music from English guitarist Chris Standring, backed by a string orchestra, and the latest from new NEA jazz master, drummer Billy Hart, with pianist Kevin Hayes and bassist Ben Street. Plus, we've got classic tracks from pianist Horace Silver and Errol Garner. I'm Carl Gerke, and you can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain.
Program funding by Arts South Dakota. It's growing season again for the arts and humanities. The American Rescue Plan is providing sizable federal grant funds to arts and humanities organizations across South Dakota. More at artssouthdakota.org/grants.
Diversity and Minority Affairs reporting on SDPB is supported by Rapid City Rotary Club and the family of Dr. Ashok Kumar.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Wednesday morning at 10 a.m., climate smart agriculture is the topic of a panel discussion at Dakota Fest in Mitchell. American Farm Bureau Federation Director of Congressional Relations Andrew Walmsley will provide an update on discussions in Washington, including a USDA-run carbon bank. It's a way to expand the use of climate-friendly farming practices, but critics say the policy doesn't necessarily meet up with the promise. So we're going to talk about that. Andrew Walmsley, welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Help us explain what a carbon bank is, especially as it relates to ag.
Well, I think there's a little bit of confusion around a carbon bank, particularly a USDA-run carbon bank. You know, this was an idea that was put out there by the transition team for the new administration. But there are climate markets that are existing. You know, there's these private markets that producers are having the opportunity to investigate and voluntarily participate in. On the USDA carbon bank, though, there's an idea of how much involvement USDA should be doing and promoting some of these markets. And I think there were some broader ideas when the administration was first getting in, but I think that's been scaled back a little bit to look at pilot projects through USDA's authorities to identify, you know, what challenges are out there for farmers who want to participate and provide these ecosystem services.
All right. So what exactly is, I mean, we're talking about not, what are the practices and how do you measure the amount of carbon that is banked for some kind of credit? Can you help us understand the sort of the science and the measurement of this?
Yeah, that's one of those issues, too, that are kind of being developed. There's obviously a lot of questions on how far you go on verification to keep cost in control, but also that there's a confidence in the market that these practices are sequestering the carbon that a purchaser would expect. So there's a couple different ways to create a credit. There's emission reduction. So a farmer who has maybe a livestock operation puts on a technology called a methane digester that captures the gas from their animal waste. That's you're destroying methane there. So you can get a credit for that. Or you're using less fuel because you're using precision agriculture and less diesel fuel. Those are emission reductions. And then what's unique about agriculture is that we can sequester carbon. And so that's certain soil practices that a farmer, if it meets the needs of their farm and makes economic sense, and maybe these carbon credits help them to get there, that's practices like utilizing cover crops or going to no-till. Is those types of soil health practices that can sequester carbon in the soil and provide a societal benefit.
Does the science of this change depending on where you're farming? Because obviously South Dakota has some vastly different sort of environments in which farmers and producers are working.
You're absolutely correct. And that's what the biggest thing we're trying to work through is to make sure that these opportunities exist for farmers, that they're aware of them, but that they have to be flexible. It's got to be voluntary. It's got to be incentive-based. Because you look at a state like South Dakota, the diversity of agriculture as you travel across the state, you expand that across the country, it only magnifies that. And especially where you're having drought issues or limited water, you know, some of these practices might not fit into your operation. And so what we're trying to do is work with USDA, work with the scientific community at a lot of our land-grant universities to try to answer as many of those questions that we can.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about the most recent international climate report and how that is changing the dialogue, especially from a USDA standpoint.
Yeah, this has definitely been a priority for this administration and for this Congress. We see it even outside of government, right? You see all these different commitments by companies, some that are within food, some that are outside. And so agriculture, it can be part of that solution. And we really do have a good story to tell in American agriculture. When you look at greenhouse gas emissions around the world, agriculture contributes close to 25% of those emissions. Here in the U.S., we're closer to 10%. We have a much more efficient production method, and we've been able to do that through our investments in research, gaining efficiencies, and there's more that we can do. And so that's really what we're trying to talk about is being part of the solution. We're an industry like others where we can work towards reducing our emissions, but what makes agriculture unique is the ability to actually sequester carbon through our land management practices.
I would think precision ag would have a huge potential for this. We've talked about that a lot on this show. What is the promise of some of this technology for the future?
Yeah, precision ag's huge. I don't think there's a one silver bullet, right? It's a buckshot approach that hopefully provides options for farmers to choose what works on their farm. So, in some instances, it's maybe improved genetics. It's either improve genetics in our seeds or on the livestock side. If there's ways we can utilize gene editing where we keep the genetic makeup of our animals whole that we've worked so hard, but we can edit them to be more efficient in their feed production, that's a reduction in emissions. There's things we're looking at, feed additives, even for animals that go into them. But then it's technologies, like you mentioned, precision ag, utilizing less diesel. It's technologies in our crops that maybe are more drought tolerant or that have a gene-edited trait that makes it more resilient to certain pests, and we don't have to spray as many pesticides. So it's really trying to figure out all the different solutions that are out there. That's what our group that we helped found, the American Farm Bureau helped found, the Food and Agriculture Climate Alliance. It's an alliance of over 80 groups now, not just ag groups, but food groups, food chain partners, and the environmental community. And we put out about 40 policy recommendations trying to see that if we can get all the options on the table and farmers have a menu to choose from.
Our guest, Andrew Elmsley, is being joined on stage at Dakota Fest by South Dakota producer Jared Nock of Carpenter and moderator Mike Pearson. That discussion on climate smart agriculture begins at 10 a.m. local time tomorrow in the Dakota Fest Education Building at the Reeves Buildings Innovation Center. Andrew, thanks so much for being here. We really appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Next, we get to welcome back to our program one of SDPB's fan favorites from the annual Tiny Desk Contest. Mateau has also joined us for a moment in sound. Now, the rapper, composer, musician, and artist is gaining new recognition as a contributor to the soundtrack of the television show Reservation Dogs. That's an FX on Hulu production that captures the malaise and low-key humor of life on a reservation in Oklahoma. The series is created by Taika Waititi and Sterling Harjo. Mateau, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be back.
And of course, you are connected with Reservation Dogs. Of course you are, because it is the newest, latest thing, and you are the newest, latest artist, and they fit together perfectly. Tell me how this kind of came to be.
Well, I connected with Sterling a couple months ago in around early February, and I had heard kind of rumors just from close friends that he was interested in bringing me onto the team. And so it's kind of this thing of just like, you know, anticipation of like, oh, is the cute guy going to ask me out on the date? Basically what it felt like.
Yeah.
And then, finally we connected, and he kind of asked like what I thought of the ideas and what I could bring to the table. And so, I've produced my music since I've begun. Basically, I've always produced my own stuff. So that kind of lends itself nicely to arranging things and composing and whatnot. And so, yeah, kind of what you said, I mean, it was a really good match. The show, I think, represents a lot of what I try to embody in my music and vice versa. And so, yeah, it's been a very good partnership in the past months.
It is taking off as far as reception. I've seen a lot. I have not seen the show because I don't have Hulu right now, but a lot of great buzz for it. What are you hearing as far as feedback for the show itself? Because you never know when you make an agreement how it's going to pan out, right?
Right. No, that's a good point. I think, yeah, it's been nothing but positivity, which has been really gratifying, because I think there's this renaissance going on with a lot of native and indigenous creators. I mean, renaissance for others. I mean, we've known how powerful our work is since the beginning, but I think people are finally seeing the humanity in a lot of our work. And so, it's nice. I think it's a great show. Not because it's native, it just happens to be native. And I think people are tuning into that. And it's definitely hitting like the zeitgeist of Indian country. I mean, it's tapping into people's, curiosities and their interests. And the humor is really on point, which is, I was raised on comedy and humor and teasing. I feel like everyone from native culture is kind of like that. And so, yeah, it's been really, really gratifying.
Yeah. How has the work of putting new music into the world? Last time I talked with you, you grew up here in South Dakota. You were off on the West Coast doing some work then the pandemic hits, and it's just been a huge challenge for artists. Tell me a little bit about how that has informed your work.
Yeah, I would say in the past year and a half, a lot of artists, we had to look very, you know, it became very insular, our worlds, because we didn't have shows, we didn't have things, potential distractions, we didn't have any of those, what now seem to be luxuries, which is really weird to think, but it's the truth. And so for me, like, I, you know, I was in college and I came back home to South Dakota to be with my parents for the past, or for like around 4 or 5 months. And so in that time span, it was great because I got to just kind of really pinpoint what I wanted to do next musically. And a lot of that was making more, I guess, sophisticated production. And so I really just kind of hunkered down and worked on my music and got it to a point of where I felt comfortable again. And so that's when you hear, you know, the new stuff. And with Reservation Dogs too, because, you know, pre-pandemic, I could not have done this show. Like, I did not have the wherewithal and like the knowledge of music to be able to do it. And so in a lot of ways, that was kind of a, it was a, like a small silver lining in the pandemic, which just allowed me to work more and like just work on myself and not be able to, you know, be distracted by shows and things. I just had to really, I guess, evolve. Like, I feel like I'm like on the next evolution of Pokemon after that, because I was able to really like transform my sound a little more.
Yeah. Well, as always, I am a big fan. You have a latest record. It's called Pleasure. We're going to close the show with a song called Constellations. Mateo, thank you so much for being here. And again, his music is featured as part of the overall soundtrack for the series Reservation Dogs. That is an FX on Hulu television show. Mateo, thanks. Thanks again.
Of course. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And thank you for listening. You a little rhyme, and I hope that you get it, cuz most people that inspire me don't ever listen, cuz they read it in the sky or they pose for the pictures, cuz they smile don't arrive if any gain in the mentions. But keep me up in your mind if you go against villains. Anybody posing tries, go and show them who's victim. Defend you until the flies eat my donuts for dinner, and the fruit of all my strides throw them right in the blender for you. And I really, really, really want to represent the set, and to do so had to do a do-si-do with death. Catch me tick-tock dancing with the devil out of breath. Catch me when I'm slipping fast off a precipice of stress and wrath.